Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 pretty much every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, a Jew who was suspended from the Labour Party for being anti-Semitic in May 2016. She's still suspended for conflating critics of the Israeli state with critics of all Jews. Her name is Jackie Walker, and she's doing a one-woman play about her situation in Bristol, which is recommended by Alexi Sale on Saturday the 3rd of February. Also, author Christopher Bolin is one of the experts on the September the 11th attacks, but he's controversial because he blames the Israeli state and secret services largely for them. He's the author of Solving 9/11, and he believes that many dual US-Israeli citizens were 9/11 terrorists and part of the subsequent cover-up. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street, and I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Jackie Walker, and I didn't really decide to write a play. Well, I suppose I did. I had this idea, but because the media were not choosing to report the truth about what had happened to me, that I would take the truth to people, and that I would do that by writing with a friend of mine, another political activist, a one-woman show that I would then take out and practice a few times and then do it at the Labour Party conference in 2017. And the thing is, it's grown its eggs since then, and it's sort of mushroomed. So I'm now travelling all over the country, and also getting bookings from abroad.
Look, without spoiling it, what's the gist of the play?
The play really is an explanation about what motivates somebody like me. So, yes, it's the one-woman show. I play five parts, including my mother and my father. And so we see really what happened to my parents involved as activists in the civil rights movement, and how their lives have influenced me as an activist. And really the question that is put is, how could somebody like me be called an anti-Semite, and what political gain might there be from calling somebody like me an anti-Semite?
Well, that's not a charge which is levelled lightly, generally. If someone's anti-Semitic, they're considered to be a Nazi, Jackie.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking, isn't it? Actually, according to my solicitor, being called an anti-Semite, which is actually just being called a racist, according to the judges, it's as bad as being accused of rape. So that's how bad it is. But the one thing I would correct you about is that I think accusations of being anti-Semitic are being done quite lightly these days, and for political reasons. And many of the people being accused of being anti-Semites, of being racist against Jews, against hating Jews, are actually not only themselves Jews, but are Jews who have been anti-racist all their lives. The one thing that joins these people is that they're all anti-Zionists.
So what's the difference between a Jew and a Zionist? I mean, surely they're both pretty much the same thing, the idea being behind the state of the creation of the State of Israel.
You see, I find that quite shocking and quite insulting, because, in fact, most Zionists are Christians. Most Zionists are actually extremist Christians in America. And no, I don't equate Jews with the state of Israel or with the state of Zionism. I'm a member of two, three Jewish organizations, and my closest political comrades are Jewish. My partner is Jewish. None of those people are Zionists. It is not the same thing to be Jewish and a Zionist.
Can you just help sort out for us this whole thing of religion or race? When someone talks about somebody as Jewish, is it one or the other or both?
Well, you see, I think one of the problems is that these things are actually quite complicated. I would say that it's a religion that also has some ethnic and cultural parts to it. But for example, if you look at some very well-known Jews, particularly, historically very well-known Jews, they weren't practicing Jews at all. Are we saying Einstein wasn't a Jew, or many of the other Jews that have never actually or either practiced or very soon dropped their Jewishness?
Well,
And certainly,
you'll be telling me that the Israeli government aren't Jewish next.
I don't know. I wouldn't have an opinion on the Israeli government's Jewishness, because I'm actually not interested in people's ethnic identity in that way.
Can you explain what happened to you and what's, your feelings about, and maybe what's the latest on it?
Happened to me was I was suspended in May 2016 initially for comments I made that I was accused of being an anti-Semite for. That was overturned within 4 weeks. But at that point, I became a sort of marked person. And then I asked some questions inside a closed session, Labour Party session, which was being run by the Jewish Labour Movement. And I was again accused of being an anti-Semite and of bringing the Labour Party into disrepute, and suspended. And I'm now being sent up to the what's called the NCC, which is sort of the highest, if you like, the highest Labour Party tribunal or court. So
So,
that's where I am now.
okay. So, what are your views, and what's your thought on whether there's any kind of justice to this calling you anti-Semitic or not?
Of course there's no justice. Of course there's no justice to it. How dare they call me an anti-Semite? An anti-Semite is somebody who hates Jews because they are Jewish. That is actually what an anti-Semite is. An anti-Semite is not somebody who, for example, challenges the status of the Israeli state, or challenges the Israeli state as a state set up for Jews and not for the people of its state. I mean, I wouldn't agree with a state that was a Muslim state or a Christian state. And it's not the same. People get this very confused. People think that we in England are a Christian state. We are not a Christian state in the same way that Israel is a Jewish state. There are all sorts of rules and regulations in Israel about who can get married to who, and those are actually entrenched within the Israeli state. And the bottom line is, we have in Israel a country that actually occupies the territories of another people. That is what it's doing.
Why is this issue in the news so much? Why do you think it's so important? You obviously do, because you're fighting this tooth and nail.
I think it's really important because I think the manipulation of charges of racism for political ends is an outrage. But also because I think the issue of Palestine and the Palestinians is one of the great causes of our time. And it's not just me who think that. Ask the people in South Africa, who themselves underwent a huge battle against apartheid. Ask them what they think of what's going on in Israel. Ask Jewish Voices for Peace. In America, ask many of the human rights movements, Amnesty International, War on Want. The issue is, in Israel, we have a government. I mean, people say, why Israel? Why aren't you talking about I don't know, Saudi Arabia or everywhere else. By the way, I do talk about Saudi Arabia. But, you know, our governments back Israel by billions, and by a hugely profitable arms trade. And that is to our shame. It's to our shame that we are involved in the oppression of a virtually defenseless people.
One of the things that's been happening recently is regular protests in Tel Aviv and elsewhere in Israel against Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the far-right leader, very little reporting in the British press, even though there's been almost wall-to-wall reporting of protests in Iran, which were actually, at least the ones in Tehran, were smaller than the ones in Israel. What do you put this down to? It doesn't really seem like we're getting equal dealing across the Middle East from the London media.
Well, no, there's partisan reporting, isn't there? There's definitely partisan reporting. I remember I had an interview once with a BBC reporter, and she said to me, off the record, of course, she said to me, off the record, I have to tell you what happens, is if we report anything about Israel and we do that in any kind of way, which is a negative, before that programme has finished, there will be hundreds of complaints, official complaints made against us. And so there's a barrage. You know, any media receive a barrage of criticism, all that has to be followed up. So I think in part there's that. And I also think it's just, you know, we are part of the American empire. The American empire has decided it's within their interest to back Israel and to condemn Iran. And we are party to that, and our media is also party to that.
Well, they're free to do that, aren't they?
Yes, they're free to do that, and we're free to point that out, or we should be free to have that pointed out without being accused of being racist.
Okay, Jackie, could you just tell us, give us one reason why we should come along and see your play?
Because you really enjoy it. It's actually, I mean, you know, Alexei Sale, who wrote a review in The Observer, said he initially came because he thought it was a duty, and he ended up just saying it was his choice for theatre for the Sunday Observer because he enjoyed it so much.
And it's on at the Palestine Museum on Broad Street on Saturday the 3rd of February at 7:30. And amazingly, if you come a little bit early, there's some food too. I imagine from the region at 6 p.m. they're doing food.
That's right. That's right. That's it.
Anyway, how do people follow your case online or in the newspapers, Jackie?
Well, they can have a look at my Facebook page, which is, I've got a couple of Facebook pages. One is called just Jackie Walker. The other one is called Jacqueline Walker. You know, and they are reasonably open. That makes it kind of difficult for me at times. But I'm pretty sure that when my case comes up in front of the Labour Party, as, for example, the Jewish Chronicle and the Board of Deputies have been sort of baying for me to be excluded from the Labour Party. I'm sure that it will be in newspapers and reported in the media.
Is there any kind of Jewish lobby in London that you would say is more balanced on Palestine, and where you can get both sides?
Oh yeah, of course there is. You know, there's a Jewish Voice for Labour, for example. There's Free Speech on Israel, which is not a totally Jewish group, but has many Jews in it. There's Labour Against the Witch Hunt. These organisations are all organisations which are either significantly Jewish or, in terms of Jewish Voice for Labour, they are actually totally Jewish. And then there's the Jewish Socialist groups. There's Jews for Justice for Palestinians. There are many Jewish groups that see what's happening in Israel as something that needs to be challenged.
Now, this witch hunt, I mean, that's a fairly strong term to use. Would you see it as that as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, what a witch hunt means is that a series of smears are set up against people who are innocent and they are excluded and victimised. And that is certainly what's happened to me and a number of my comrades.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Christopher Bolin, and I'm an investigative journalist. I worked for a weekly newspaper in Washington, D.C. From 2000 until 2006. And one of the big stories that I spent a lot of time covering was the 9/11 attacks, the September 11th attacks in Washington and New York. And I wrote a book based on my articles called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And I also published a book called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles, which contains all my articles about 9/11 over a 11-year period from 2001 through to 2012. And those two books are the big work, Solving 9/11.
Okay, so look, Chris, Solving 9/11 is an intriguing title because many people are calling for reinvestigation, that sort of thing. It almost sounds like you've done that investigation and you've got a list of indictments. So who is it that was really behind the September the 11th attacks? I don't think there's many people now that believe that it was Osama bin Laden in a cave in Bora Bora in Afghanistan.
No, the evidence strongly indicates that it was a Israeli military intelligence operation. It was a military operation designed to look like an Arab attack. And it was done by the political leadership of the Likud party in Israel. The plan for the attacks was first brought out in the 1970s under Menachem Begin, the former terrorist of the Irgun. And apparently they put the operation to work, and it took them, a couple of decades before they were able to pull it off.
Okay, this operation of Begin's, I mean, that is certainly could be damning evidence, but I need to hear from you, what evidence have you got that there was some kind of plan by Begin which was similar to what actually happened on 9/11? What, for example, was this plan called?
Well, the plan is called the War on Terror, and it was rolled out as a doctrine when Menachem Begin had an international conference on international terrorism in Jerusalem in 1979, in July, at the Netanyahu Institute, which was basically Bibi Netanyahu, the current Prime Minister of Israel, and his father, Ben Zion Milakovsky, from Warsaw. And they had this conference. It was a four-day conference in Jerusalem. George Herbert Walker Bush was attended and spoke at the final session. And this is when they rolled out the idea, the doctrine of the United States and the Western allies going into the Middle East with their militaries and waging war against Israel's enemies across the region.
At the time, there was a lot of Arab terrorism going on, wasn't there? I mean, they were looking at a way of dealing with people like the PLO.
Well, there was some terrorism going on. The international conference on the conference on international terrorism in Jerusalem under Menachem Begin was based on a hyped up fabrication of the numbers of the data. But that's just to show you that it was a fraudulent premise from the beginning. But the idea was to sell, and at the Jerusalem conference on international terrorism, actually, all of the terrorism was blamed on the Soviet Union. In 1979, they thought that was the way to get the United States, riled up, increase this tension between the superpowers, and they blamed it all on the Soviet Union. That's no longer is that the narrative, but the game goes on.
But hang on, because at the time, I mean, that was during the Cold War. You're in a situation where surely both the NATO side and the Soviet side were, using proxies. They had small countries which they were using proxies to, attack, get at one side or the other. The Cold War was something which was waged through proxies, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the Menachem Begin, you see, the reason why they blamed it all on the Soviet Union, wrongly or rightly, mostly wrongly, was that, you know, they would find some Palestinians who had studied, you know, in Moscow or university, someplace in Russia, and say that is a proof that these guys are being run by Moscow. They weren't. The Palestinian terrorists, you know, they had their own thing going on. But the thing was is that the Israelis need to maintain hostility between the superpowers, between the United States and Russia, Soviet Union, in order to keep the tension off of them, in order to keep the pressure off of the Middle East and Israel compromising and finding a way to live with the Palestinians. In order to prevent that from coming to the fore, they need to maintain this hostility, this mostly artificial hostility between the United States and Russia today.
Okay, so the actual events of the September the 11th attack, have you got any evidence that those were had Israeli involvement of some kind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Solving 9/11 book is full of it. I have proof, I have evidence that the ideation, the prediction and preparation of the public mind for planes flying into buildings. This was done in the 1970s at exactly the same time. Arnon Milchan, for example, made the film The Medusa Touch with Richard Burton, in which the climactic scene is a Boeing 747 flying into the Pan Am building in New York City. And this film was made in 1978. And he made other films about planes flying into buildings. He actually made a film. His business partner, Rupert Murdoch, made a film called The Lone Gunman, in which a hijacked passenger aircraft was flown into the World Trade Center. And it aired on Fox TV in March of 2001.
But that's not really evidence of direct Israeli involvement, is it? Just there are films about all sorts of Towering Infernos, another one. You know, there's lots of these kinds of films around, Chris. What about anything specific that ties the Israelis to the 9/11 attacks?
Oh, yes. It's a preponderance of evidence. What you find is that at every key corner, at every point in the 9/11 saga, from the preparation of the ideas, the prediction, Issa Harel, for example, the head of the Mossad, the founding father of the Mossad, predicted in 1979 that Arabs would attack the tallest towers in New York City. He said they would do this in 1979, 21 years before. And then you find that Israelis hit some of his lieutenants from the Mossad in the 1980s. Tried to get the security contract for the World Trade Center. And being rebuffed by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, they then went to work for the people who did get the security contract for the World Trade Center, Jules Krull, and then they found themselves in control of the towers. And then, you know, the possession of the building, the ownership of the building was turned over to a man named Larry Silverstein, and, you know, it just goes on and on and on. So at every single point of the 9/11 saga, where the project needs a decision to go ahead, the person who makes the decision is either an Israeli or a Zionist agent of the state of Israel.
What about the day of September the 11th itself, with the hijackings, the aircraft, hitting buildings, hitting the Pentagon, this sort of thing? Is there any actual evidence some kind of either, because these were surprise attacks, foreknowledge by the Israelis or in any other way, involvement in the security failures? Because it was a massive security failure, obviously.
Oh, yeah. As I said, the people that ran the security for the World Trade Center, it was a company called Krull Associates, headed by Jules Krull, in which these lieutenants of the Mossad, then Zion or Shalom Ben-Dor, Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor, was working for, one of Issa Harel's main lieutenants. These were the people who ran the security for the World Trade Center. And then there were all the reports about, you know, the power being shut down the weekend before 9/11, what have you. But the thing is that there was a warning given on an Israeli messenger service called Odigo, about 2 hours before the actual attacks, at 8:45 in the morning, in which people who had this Israeli instant messenger platform application were warned of the attacks 2 hours before they happened.
Amazing. Anyway, I mean, some people would just say, well, you're just another one of these anti-Semitic racists, Chris.
Well, you have to read, they have to read the evidence and the articles. If they read the article, the information presented in the Solving 9/11 book with an open mind, they would find that the evidence is compelling. The evidence is compelling, as I said, that the planning and the carrying out and the cover-up of the 9/11 saga has all been done by Zionists or Israeli agents. You see, as Nixon said, you know, it's not the crime that gets you, it's the cover-up. The cover-up of 9/11, these people leave behind distinctive markers. You know who's doing it. You know who, you know, in the United States, we have today a situation where the media and the government fail to refuse to address the 9/11 situation at all. The media, for 16 years, has refused to give the American population any information about what really happened on 9/11. And at the same time, they promoted the war agenda. Because, as I said, the war on terror is the reason why 9/11 was done. And this is all a Zionist, you know, project. The war on terror is a project to implement the Yenon plan, the Israeli Yenon plan, to break up the Arab states into ethnic enclaves, which is exactly what's happening today in Syria, in Iraq, in Sudan, you know, across the Middle East.
Okay, what about the Saudis? You haven't mentioned them because the hijackers were Saudis, weren't they?
Well, if they were hijackers, we don't even know they were hijackers. I mean, you know, they talk about these 28 pages. They talk about the two Saudis who were supposedly on Flight 77 that supposedly hit the Pentagon. But there's no evidence of Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon. So, you know, whether these Saudis were on Flight 77 or not is a moot point. If you have no evidence of a plane called Flight 77 striking the Pentagon. And so the entire discussion of who the terrorists or who the hijackers were is almost a moot point. The head of the FBI a year after 9/11 said that the FBI has no evidence whatsoever to prove who the hijackers were on the plane. And so it's like there's the hijacking scenario of Arabs hijacking these planes and flying into the building is just another level of deception.
What about the FBI? Because surely they should have been on the case here. It's a big failure for them. They should have been all over the various terrorists as they were preparing for the attack.
Well, here again, there was no investigation of 9/11. The investigation should have been carried out by Michael Chertoff, who was the assistant attorney general, an Israeli national, by the way. He's an Israeli-American dual national. His mother was one of the founding members of the Mossad. And he was the person who had the portfolio to investigate and prosecute the 9/11 crimes. But we had at that time a brand new director of the FBI, Mr. Mueller, the man who's running the Russia investigation right now. And as the head of the FBI, there was no investigation. There was no criminal investigation. The evidence was destroyed from the very beginning, 24/7. And so instead of having a criminal investigation, instead of using the law enforcement and the FBI and the courts to prosecute the crimes of 9/11, the Bush administration declared it to be an act of war and took the nation to war.
What about some of the latest that's come out about the September the 11th attacks, Chris? Because I imagine that you know, this is something which is one of your special subjects. It would be interesting to know, you know, because what happens often with these situations is you get some big terrorist attack, you get told what to think about it, and then over the succeeding years, various little bits of information trickle out, but they never hit the news. So what should we know that the London media, the corporate media, are not telling us over the last 6 or 8 months about what's been happening, or what's been revealed recently, or what you've managed to dig out?
Yeah, well, my most recent book, the one that I came out with this summer, is called The War on Terror, the plot to rule the Middle East, because 9/11 and the discussion of the minutiae, the details of what happened or didn't happen on 9/11, is futile. There's really no sense in talking about it because we know that we've been lied to. We know that the government and the media are covering up the truth about what really happened. I presented very shortly in my video, I show the evidence of molten metal falling off the building, the evidence of the molten metal found in the dust of the World Trade Center, and things like this. And point out that this has never been discussed by the mainstream media. because if the mainstream media were to show, to discuss the evidence of molten steel, molten iron in the World Trade Center, it would debunk the entire, official report.
So what's the significance of this molten metal then?
Well, I mean, before the South Tower fell, there was, for about 7 minutes, molten iron, presumably molten iron, poured off the 81st floor in a cascade of white-hot, yellow-hot molten iron. And this was tons and tons of molten iron pouring off this floor, which is the floor where the plane struck, the South Tower. Now, it's like, if they were to discuss this, if they were to present this, it was filmed on WABC TV, by the way, I mean, which is the ABC TV affiliate in New York, so it's no secret. And the official reports, the FEMA documents, they discussed it, but there was never any discussion in the mainstream media. Because had the mainstream media, the New York Times or the newspapers, had they simply discussed this, they would have to rethink the official story. Because there is no way that burning jet fuel can melt iron or steel. It's just not possible. So there has to be another explanation for the tens of tons of molten iron that we're seeing falling from the South Tower.
So what was it, Chris? What do you think? What do you think it was?
I think that floor was packed with tons of thermite in large boxes that were disguised as computer batteries in the computer floor of Fuji Bank. I think it was on the 82nd floor. It may be also that the plane contained thermite. That's possible. But we both planes flew into secure computer rooms, and I suspect that both of those rooms had been prepared with large boxes of thermite.
Okay, so have you got any evidence then that the planes were somehow switched, that the planes that took off that weren't necessarily the same planes that flew into the World Trade Center?
Well, the videos and the photographs of the plane that struck the South Tower indicate that the plane had a what appears to be a missile pod mounted on the fuselage below the plane. And furthermore, the plane does not have the characteristics of a United Airlines aircraft. Rather, it has the appearance of being a 767 tanker aircraft. Namely, it has a groove down the middle of the bottom of the fuselage. And as I said, it has this piece of equipment that would not have been on a passenger aircraft. And that, milliseconds before the plane struck the tower, that missile pod emitted or ejected what appears to be a white-hot missile that went right through the building, burning white-hot. So that appears to have been a depleted uranium warhead that was extremely hot, that ignited everything on the floor, busted everything that was passing through that floor, and passed through the other side burning white-hot.
What about the aircraft on their way? Is there any evidence that, because planes quite clearly took off, mm-hmm. with loaded with passengers, mm-hmm. what you're suggesting here is a drone or a military plane hit the World mm-hmm. Trade Center. I must admit, I agree with you. If you look at the pictures of those planes, they do not look like commercial airliners.
We don't know exactly the flight paths, but we do have some records that show that these both planes that struck New York City that day converged and crossed paths over formerly Stewart Air Force Base in New York State, and that was a privately owned airport at the time. It may have been that the planes most likely were landed someplace as per the Operation Northwoods scenario, and their flight paths were taken over by the militarized drones.
What about, let's go back to my question about some of the more recent evidence that you've uncovered mm-hmm. about this plot to rule the Middle East. What as this news unfolds about Syria, about Iran, etc., mm-hmm. what is the plan, do you think?
Well, the plan is the Israeli plan to dominate the Middle East by breaking up the large secular states like Iraq and Syria and breaking them up into ethnic statelets. Exactly what you see, for example, in Syria today, with the United States and the Kurdish allies controlling the eastern part of Syria, east of the Euphrates River. You have the Kurdish section in the north of Iraq where they're pumping, where the oil is owned by the Rothschild family, and they are, declaring autonomy or making these efforts to become, to break up the states of Iraq and Syria. It's happening. The enterprise to break up Syria has been obstructed by the intervention by the Soviets and the Iranians. Otherwise, Syria would have ceased to be a nation several years ago. But, you know, this was all planned decades in advance. It's called the Yinon Plan. Oded Yinon was the person who wrote it. It was published in Israel in 1982 and translated into English in the same year by Dr. Israel Shahar. And it presents this plan in clear English that the Israelis intend to break up all of the nations, all of the Arab states in the Middle East, and to break them up into ethnic statelets. This is basically called Balkanization because it's exactly what was done to Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was like the test case, and it worked very well, and that's what they're doing now. That's the whole purpose of the war. There is no American interest in this war. The Americans and the Allies are fighting for Israel. This is to give Israel hegemony over in the region. There's no American interest in this whatsoever. No valid American.
So what's the ultimate goal then?
Yeah, to fragment the Middle East into a patchwork quilt.
Well, yeah, but I mean, once that's happened, if it does happen, is that it? And what's the point of doing that?
Well, you know, Iraq was always the most formidable foe of Israel. So the destruction of Saddam Hussein's regime and his military was a significant, advance or a success for the Israeli state, for the military elite there. Military intelligence, as well as Syria. Syria, you know, and so, for example, now Israel, of course, you know, is occupying the Golan Heights, has been occupying the Golan Heights for a long time, since 1967, and they intend to keep it. And so that if they are able to fragment Syria so that the Golan Heights no longer has a valid return address, then there will be nobody to challenge Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, which Israel depends on very much for the water that runs off the Golan Heights, and also it's a very mineral-rich, oil-rich area where, again, the Rothschilds own a lot of the oil.
What you're saying sounds as if it's plausible. So why haven't we heard this from any of the outlets in the United States and Britain and even Europe on the corporate media?
Because they're controlled. I mean, they don't talk about this. As I said, they have never talked about the molten metal, which is, you know, found in all the reports about 9/11. About at least 6% of the dust of the World Trade Center was these tiny droplets of molten iron. Well, that's a fact. That's proof. But the media doesn't talk about it. Why not? Because the media is involved in covering up the truth of 9/11 and promoting the war on terror. So if the media is not going to discuss the ulterior motives and the underlying Zionist strategy when they're out to protect the Zionist war and to advance it.
Why is the media then protecting the Zionists?
Well, because, you know, in the United States at least, the media is very much under the control of Zionist owners. For example, CBS News is owned and run, CEO, and owned by the grandnephew of David Ben-Gurion. His name is Moonves, Leslie Moonves. He's the grandnephew of David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, the first prime minister and president of the state of Israel.
How have you got on, trying to get some traction with the press in taking you seriously? And have you managed to get on to debate some of these points with Zionists and some of these dual citizen U.S.-Israeli citizens?
There's no debate of 9/11 truth or the war on terror in the United States at all. There's no discussion of it. There's very little discussion of the war on terror, which is why I wrote this book, The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East, and why I spent 2 months, you know, traveling around the United States. Because what's peculiar is that the war on terror is now America's longest war. It's the longest war in U.S. history and the most expensive war in U.S. history. And there is virtually no resistance to it by the public. The reason why there's no resistance by the public is because the media has completely pulled the wool over their eyes and they think that the war on terror is a good thing.
Well, with Trump, surely it is. I mean, he's actually trying to make sure that terrorists aren't allowed to come and migrate into the United States anymore.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, he maintains the narrative. He has come out on several occasions supporting the notion, the false narrative, that 9/11 was carried out by Arabs in Afghanistan. And this is demonstrably false. And the fact that he supports this false narrative and means that he is a continuation of this fraudulent war on terror.
Former property developer, Donald Trump has actually come out, hasn't he, and said that he believed that there were actually bombs in the World Trade Center.
Yes, he said that on day one. He said that on the very first day. A couple of days later, he changed his tune. But originally, he said that, yes, there were bombs that went off simultaneously with the plane striking the building, which is pretty close to what happened.
What's your take on the wider geopolitics, Chris, particularly with Trump's saber-rattling over North Korea and also with the process of Brexit kind of working its way through here in Europe?
Well, I don't know about the Brexit thing and what's going to happen out of that. And the North Korea thing is largely, I think, a distraction. They have these distractions that they apply from time to time when their stories aren't going well. And the story that hasn't gone very well is Syria. Since the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah have helped Syria, I mean, just today, for example, Syria is making advances in Idlib. And it's getting the Turks all worked up and the Americans, Israelis are bombing Syria today as we speak. They've bombed Syria several times today, around Damascus. And, this army of drones, this fleet of drones that tried to attack the Russians last weekend, all of this stuff is happening. And the Syrian army is reclaiming its territory inch by inch. And it means that the United States and the Zionist plan for Syria has failed. And this is a huge, an epic failure for the United States and Israel. And so when they don't want to talk about that, they quickly, turn down the lights on Syria and turn the lights up on North Korea or whatever. I can't see any reason why the United States should go to war with North Korea. That's ridiculous. They bombed the hell out of them in the 50s, and I think that they should just... But it provides a very good distraction.
You're talking about drones being used now in Syria against the Russians. Mm-hmm. Do the Russians have any kind of countermeasures against that? Because it does seem as if the Russians have used Syria as a bit of a testing ground, possibly,
yeah, sure.
In a way, in the run-up to possibly a wider war.
Yeah, sure. Well, of course, it's a place where these armies are testing their technology, and the Russians shot down about six of these drones, and then they were able to land, to hijack or hack into and land at least three or four of them, and they're primitive little drones that were armed. But they point out that there was an American American spy aircraft that was flying up there off the coast of Syria between Latakia and Tartus. For 4 hours at the time when this drone attack was going on. So they suggest that the United States was actually guiding these drones because they were, satellite guided. So I don't know, but I mean, as you say, all sides are applying all kinds of weapons and tactics that we have not seen before. They're using Syria as a testing ground, as a bloodstained, battleground where they can play their games and use their proxies and use their technology, and it's just awful.
Is this just the Cold War coming back again? Is it the same powers involved, really?
No, it's not. It's not, because the Israelis are the primary actors. They're the primary manipulators of the Allied side, and perhaps to the Russian side as well. I don't know. I don't know that much about, but I know the Israelis and the Russians have fairly good relations. But the United States is following Israel's dictates in the region. And so we now have a situation where the United States is fighting Israel's wars for it.
Well, look, there's a lot of Americans who would say, how on earth can you say that Israel has got enough power, a small state like that, to have so much control over the United States? That's just a crazy conspiracy theory.
Well, they might say that, but it's the truth. I mean, if you look at, like, 1967, when the Israelis attacked USS Liberty, an American spy ship off the coast of Egypt, and it was a murderous attack. They killed 34 Americans and injured 174 sailors, and it was completely covered up. In fact, the President of the United States called back the aircraft that had been launched to defend the ship that was under this murderous attack. So how? I mean, they control the levers of power. You know, America is a big country, and you control the levers of power, you control the country. You control the president, you control the Congress, you control the Federal Reserve System, you control this and that. You know, the city of New York, you control the governor of New York, you control the media, you control the country. It's simple.
What's your, looking into your crystal ball for 2018, and maybe even beyond, what's your thoughts about what the consequences of the September the 11th attacks are going to be in the Middle East and elsewhere? Because I think it's pretty clear that this war on terror, even though it's a war on an abstract noun, it's actually using terror to defeat terror, which is quite clearly absurd. Whereabouts do you think this may be heading, Chris?
Well, it's going on, because the war on terror, apart from what you said, it's also a legal term in America. It is the terminology they use when they authorize military action and funding for a war against some gang of so-called terrorists. For example, in Africa, in places like Niger, the U.S. government is fighting the war on terror. So the funding for the operation comes from the war on terror funding, and the authorization to use military force from 2001. And the war is considered part of the war on terror. And the United States is fighting wars across scores of countries today under the guise, under the name, under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Now, it's gone very well for them. It's gone for 16 years. It's gone like a charm. Why should they stop it? I think what we're going to see now is perhaps another kind of false flag terror attack, maybe in the Persian Gulf or something like that, in which the blame will be put on Iranians, for example, and it will open up, it'll give them a casus belli to aggress Iran. So the war agenda has gone very well for the people that did 9/11 for 16 years. And I think that it's very likely that they will continue this war agenda. It's not going to stop unless we stop until the people of the United States and the people of the world stop the war, you know, stand up and have protests and take significant effective action against it. It's not going to stop. There's no reason for them to stop it. They're making tons of money. They're accomplishing the Zionist goals. They're raking in lots of resources and money and enjoying playing their military games around the world. Why should they stop? And I'm afraid that Iran is the seventh country on the list of seven countries. So I suppose that's where they're going next.
What's China's role in all this?
China's an observer. It's a superpower now. I'm a little bit puzzled by these shipwrecks that are, you know, these collisions that are occurring. First two Navy vessels and then this Iranian freighter, oil freighter. These collisions that are occurring off the coast of China. I suspect there may be some, you know, computer hacking going on there. But in any case, I see that China is trying to be a stabilizing power in its region. And I think Russia is doing the same. Russia and China and, you know, Iran, these countries are rational actors, and they are trying to find stability and prosperity in their region and in the world. The United States, unfortunately, is now afflicted with a very bad case of Zionism, and it and Britain and other countries that are afflicted with the same disease are waging war for Israel mindlessly, squandering money they don't have, and you know, sacrificing the lives of their young men for a foreign agenda. It's obscene.
Also, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is quite a focus, because the Zionists are very keen on rebuilding Solomon's Temple there. The only trouble is that they've got the Dome of the Rock, which was one of the biggest and the first mosques ever built in the world, right in the middle of it. So quite clearly there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. If the Zionists do manage to build their Solomon's Temple, that's going to mean demolishing one of the most holy sites in Islam.
Yeah, that's true. But you see that the Israelis, under the leadership of Netanyahu, are doing a lot of crazy things, and President Trump has done a lot of crazy things vis-a-vis the Middle East as well. His recognition of Jerusalem, in contravention to all international law and United Nations resolutions, has thrown a wrench into the works. These Zionist psychopaths like Netanyahu can only go so far until they crash into reality. And, I don't know what's going to happen. Netanyahu has a lot of bad press and he's got a lot of legal problems. So he may be ending his career may be coming to an end. I just wonder who's going to replace him. I wouldn't be surprised if it would be Ehud Barak would come along again. But, the Israelis have to have a collision course with reality coming up.
Do you want to just remind us of the book titles, finally?
Yeah, sure. The book, the Solving 9/11 set of books is called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And that's a smaller book. The larger book is called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. And that is a larger format book. They're a set of books under the Solving 9/11 title. And they're available through Amazon.com or at, any bookseller. Or they can get them through my website, bollyn.com, bollyn.com. And my most recent book is called The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East. And that book is a much smaller book, but very important because people need to understand what is the war on terror in reality, what it really is. It's not at all what they tell you it is.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Jackie Walker and Christopher Bollin, the author of Solving 9/11. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM pretty much every Tuesday at noon. 93.2 FM, that is, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.